Thank you very much. I'll reiterate what I said yesterday in introductions. I'm really thrilled to be here. You know, it's not a long trip for me. A lot of you have made long trips to be here and have been working in this area a lot longer than I have. So I'm really thrilled to be here and to be able to talk to all of you today. My goal is to talk about the state-federal stalemate over marijuana law and policy that right now, as most of you know, and as I'll talk a little bit about, marijuana is still prohibited under federal law, but now almost exactly half of our states have taken a very different view. And I want to talk about what the legal significance is of that, what it means in 24 states in the District of Columbia that marijuana is legal under state law but prohibited under federal law. For some of you, this will be a review. For some of you, it will be a crash course. I'm going to try and split that down the middle. So please feel free to jump in with questions. I don't want to bore you guys. I don't want to talk about things that are not pertinent. So as I go along, if something is unclear, please feel free to jump in. So I always start with a joke. People always ask me what the difference is between medical and recreational marijuana, and in Colorado I can tell them recreational marijuana have the blue tags and medical have the yellow tags. This is marijuana growing in Colorado side by side. Half of that goes into our medical system, half goes into our recreational system. It's a strange way to run a railroad, but it's sort of what's accumulated here in our state. So let's see. What I'll talk about are the three stages of marijuana law reform in the United States, or of marijuana law in the United States. And the point I want to make is they all overlap, right? So since 1937, with the Marijuana Tax Act, marijuana has been a prohibited substance. That became much clearer in 1970 with the passage of the Controlled Substances Act, and most states went ahead and passed parallel criminal provisions. Since 1996, as most of you know, starting in California, states now, 24 plus the District of Columbia, have passed medical marijuana laws. These generally create an exception to existing criminal laws. Marijuana remains criminal in those states, but it's a affirmative defense for a number of people if they can show either a doctor's recommendation or a medical need. Okay, that's very unsatisfying. It means in a lot of states you can still be arrested. And you can tell the judge or the prosecutor, hey, I needed this for medical purposes. It doesn't legalize that conduct for medical users. And that's, as I said, a pretty unsatisfying result. Since 2012, we now know that four states plus DC have gone further and have removed a number of their criminal prohibitions, not all their criminal prohibitions. That is, when I tell people about what Colorado did, I say that some marijuana conduct is legal, but a lot of it still remains illegal, even under state law. When people say, oh, Colorado or marijuana is legal in Colorado, I say, well, sort of. If you're growing it in your basement and selling it to your friends, you're breaking the law in Colorado. Right? So it's not that marijuana is legal in this state. It's this possession of under an ounce is legal. Possession of the marijuana that you grew in your house is legal. Giving it away without remuneration is legal. But lots and lots and lots of conduct remains illegal. Giving it to kids, selling it without a license, driving with it, right? So it's not that marijuana is completely legal. It's that there's a carve out in these states. Furthermore, the four states that have legalized have implemented regulatory regimes for dealing with this. They haven't just said it's legal and anyone can sell it. Rather, they've said you can get a license to sell it. You have to pay for that license. You have to comply with the licensing requirements. You have to pay taxes on it. So rather than being a lawless regime, it's in fact a quite complicated legal regime, which is good for me, good for the lawyers in the room. It means we get to stay in business, right? If it were legal, there wouldn't be any questions for us to answer. There are actually, it turns out, lots of questions that we, our clients, my students, need to be able to answer. Okay, and so what I'm going to go through today is how do we deal with the fact that all three of these things, federal prohibition, 24 states with medical, four states with legal, how do those things coexist together? There's never been anything quite like what's going on with marijuana now, where something remains prohibited at the federal level, and an increasing number of states are legalizing, taxing, and regulating it. I've talked to my historian friends, they always say, oh, sure, something's been like that before. It's okay. Well, tell me what. I've stumped them all so far. So we're in uncharted territory. Nothing in U.S. history has sort of prepared us for this. And that leads to some complications. All right. The bad news first. What does the Controlled Substances Act actually say and do? It makes, and as I said, this is going to be a review for most of the people in the room, but it's important to sort of lay this groundwork. It makes marijuana a Schedule I narcotic, and the challenges to that have generally failed. Being a Schedule I narcotic means, obviously, manufacture, sale, and possession are all prohibited. No DEA-certified doctor can prescribe the drug. And basically, anyone who is producing, anyone who is selling, anyone who is giving away, possessing, all of those things are criminal. The criminal penalties are huge, right? If you go to the big grow facilities, there's a beautiful one right down the road in Basalt. If you go to these big production facilities with thousands of plants, that is an amount of marijuana that can lead to 25 years in prison. Okay, no violence, no guns, no nothing. Just that amount can get you 25 years in prison. That remains true even in a state like Colorado that has, quote, legalized. Furthermore, legislative and judicial challenges to this have consistently failed. Gonzalez against Rake, known to most of you, confirmed the power of Congress to regulate marijuana, even the marijuana that Angel Rage was growing on her property for her use, could be regulated by the federal government. It wasn't being sold to anyone, wasn't traveling out of state, didn't matter. It affected interstate commerce, therefore it could be regulated by the federal government. A lesser-known case, Oakland Cannabis Buyers Cooperative, decided 4 years earlier, said that it is no defense in a federal prosecution that you are acting in compliance with state law. I'll say that again. It's no defense in a federal prosecution that you are acting in compliance with state law. And more than that, if you are charged under the CSA in a federal court, the words medical marijuana can't be used. The jury cannot know that you were a caregiver, cannot know that you were using this yourself, cannot know that you were giving it away without charging. Those are irrelevant. The only question is whether you're violating the CSA and whether all of the provisions of the CSA were shown. Medical use is irrelevant. More recently, in 2015 in California, the district court there, as district courts have in D.C. and elsewhere, said that it is rational and reasonable for the federal government to have classified marijuana as a Schedule I drug, despite what we've heard, despite what a lot of you believe and know. It was reasonable for the federal government to classify marijuana alongside heroin and LSD as a drug without medical use. Okay? So while all this is happening in the states, we have to live with this, right? Things are changing fast in the states and very slowly at the federal level. Marijuana is illegal. The courts have said it may stay illegal. Congress has the power to make it illegal, and Congress can make it illegal everywhere, regardless of state law. Excuse me. So where does that leave state law reform? Well, one thing that we know for sure is that a state, by legalizing, can't protect its citizens from federal enforcement. That's what the Supremacy Clause means. We can say in Colorado, it's legal, or certain parts of it are legal under our state law. Federal government disagrees. Federal prosecutor, we have a former federal prosecutor in the room, can come into the state of Colorado, can prosecute people who are in compliance with state law, and the fact that they are compliant with state law is irrelevant. Okay? So even though we've legalized in Colorado, it has no effect in federal court. But Congress has put some limits on the ability of the federal government to enforce its own law. I don't know how many people have heard of the Rohrabacher-Farr Amendment. About half of us. This was, in the last two Congresses, has been an amendment added to the continuing finance bill that's passed at the end of each year. And it says the following. None of the money, the funds, made available in this act to the Department of Justice may be used with respect to the states of Alabama, Alaska, Arizona, California, all 24, I omitted most of them, to prevent such states from implementing their own state laws that authorize the use, distribution, possession, or cultivation of medical marijuana. Notice the word medical in there. It's an important word. Yes, sir? God, that's a good question. I think they just listed the states. Yeah. Right. Yeah, so it's an exclusive list. I think I agree with that. I think that's right. So this was passed in each of the last two Congresses. What does it mean? Right? It says Justice Department can't use money authorized by the Congress to, I want to get the language right, to prevent such states from implementing their own medical marijuana laws. In United States against the Marin Alliance for Medical Marijuana, Judge Breyer, brother of Justice Breyer, ruled that this prevents CSA prosecutions in those states against medical marijuana businesses. That is, that Congress, through the Rohrabacher-Farr Amendment, prohibited the Justice Department from enforcing federal law against those in compliance with state medical marijuana laws. And that's not what it says. Right? And the Justice Department continues to maintain that that's not what it says. They declined to appeal that ruling, but there's a Ninth Circuit opinion in a case that's a number of consolidated prosecutions will soon, any day now, be deciding whether the Rohrabacher-Farr Amendment prohibits the enforcement of federal law against those in compliance with state law. That would be huge, right? We'll see that the, you know, we've heard about the Obama memos that say this is not a good use of resources to go after a certain people. This is a prohibition, at least as read by Judge Breyer. Okay. Yes, question. I don't know the answer to that. I'm pretty sure I quoted this directly to me doesn't make much difference because it was in the federal appropriations bill, right? All the feds can appropriate is federal monies. Yeah, that's good reading. I noticed that and I may have inadvertently omitted the word federal here. Okay, good. Right. So if this, reading by Judge Breyer and others is upheld, that will be a prohibition. That will keep the federal government from enforcing against medical marijuana laws. In a state like Colorado and a state like Washington, can the feds still prosecute people in the recreational business? Absolutely. Rohrabacher-Farr doesn't speak to that at all, and on that I think everyone agrees. Preemption is something that we hear a lot about. The Controlled Substances Act, Section 903, under federal law, says that the CSA is not exclusive. That is, states are free to pass their own marijuana laws. Not everything is like that. So, for example, the patent system. Federal patent law is exclusive. States can't issue patents. Only the federal government does. Congress has preempted the field. No other regulations are permitted by any state, even if they're perfectly consistent with federal law. Congress explicitly did not do that with regard to marijuana law. Section 903, which talks about preemption, says that state laws are preempted only if they create a positive conflict such that the two laws cannot be read together. Now, what does that mean? Well, you might say, well, that applies to all 24 states, they're legalizing something that's prohibited. That's not exactly the way this language has been read. One thing you could read it as is what's called conflict preemption, which says state laws are preempted only to the extent that it's impossible to comply with both state and federal law. Well, isn't that the case with regard to state and federal marijuana laws? No. It's easy to comply with both state and federal marijuana laws. How? Just don't use it. right? If you don't use it, you're complying with state law and you're complying with federal law. What would be a true conflict is if the state of Colorado said, wait for it, right? Each person must, each morning, consume marijuana. Then each of us would have to scratch our heads and say, well, state law, federal law, I have to choose one. Right? That is, no state has yet done that. Interestingly, this idea of conflict preemption makes certain regulatory possibilities less likely. So, for example, I was on the governor's commission to implement Amendment 64 here in Colorado. One thing that the public health people came to us and said is, hey, from alcohol, we've learned that government-run stores, ABC stores, are much better from a public health perspective than privately run stores. They don't do targeted advertising. They don't have garish signs. They're better about ID checks. Much better idea. Why don't you guys do that here? I said, sorry, conflict preemption. Why? Well, some public employee in one of those stores would have the job of selling marijuana. That person would have to decide between their obligation to the state, sell marijuana, and their obligation to the federal government, don't sell marijuana, right? That would be a conflict in that person between state and federal laws, and we have yet to see any state, with exception of that one odd municipality in Oregon, that has used state-run marijuana stores, and I think conflict preemption is the other. I'm sorry, is the reason. Obstacle preemption also forbids state laws that create an impermissible obstacle to the implementation of federal law. Well, okay, if Colorado's laws aren't a direct conflict, certainly they're an obstacle. Right? The fact that we have legalized this, doesn't that mean that we are creating an obstacle to the enforcement of federal law? And I think that the answer to that is what's known as the anti-commandeering principle. Right? The federal government cannot force the states to help them enforce federal law. We know this from the Prince case. Prince against the United States said that the federal government could not order local law enforcement officials to participate in a federal program of background checks for handguns. Okay? Said, look, the federal government can do this. You can do this in every state. You can have U.S. Marshals do this. But what you can't do is commandeer the state apparatus and make it your puppet. And while I personally didn't like that result much in Prince, in the marijuana context, it's really important. Because what it says is, you, the states, don't have to keep your prohibitions on the books. You can repeal them. Or you can leave them on the books and ignore them, right? What decriminalization is, or what, when people make marijuana enforcement the lowest priority, they're doing that. And furthermore, the federal government can't force the states to enforce the CSA or to help enforce the CSA. As I said, the federal government can come in Colorado, can arrest all of you up on the roof, but it can't tell the sheriff who spoke yesterday, hey, all those people are smoking weed up on the roof, stop that. Sheriff can say, I don't want to stop it. You can stop it, but I'm not going to. Okay? So this is the sort of place we are. Federal government can come in and do this, hasn't been very willing to do so. States can legalize, states can regulate, but they can't insulate their citizens. That's true with regard to legalization, but what about these state regulatory apparatuses like we have here in Colorado? You've all probably heard about the Nebraska and Oklahoma against Colorado lawsuit that was filed in the Supreme Court back in 2014. There, the states of Oklahoma and Nebraska said, we are suffering from Colorado's legalization. More marijuana is coming into our state. We are spending more money. Tell them they can't do that. What was interesting is they attacked only the licensing scheme. They said, of course, Colorado as a sovereign state is free to legalize or criminalize whatever conduct it wants. But what they can't do is put the state imprimatur on conduct that violates federal law. They can't license that conduct. They can't encourage that conduct. They can't benefit from that conduct through taxing. And you, the Supreme Court, should tell them that their laws are preempted. The Supreme Court, as we all now know, declined this opportunity. In fact, the federal government asked them not to. That was pretty fascinating. The Supreme Court said, this seems to raise some interesting federalism issues. I'd love to know what the federal government thinks about this. The United States Solicitor General weighed in and said, we're not too concerned about this. We don't think you should take this case. And in March 21st of this year, the Supreme Court decided 6-2 not to. Doesn't mean Nebraska and Oklahoma have gone away. They have joined a suit that's pending in the District of Colorado, and they're going to continue to press this claim there. They're going to continue to maintain that our laws are preempted by federal law. Okay? They're joining essentially the sheriff's lawsuit. I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to talk to the sheriff yesterday about this. A number of sheriffs here in the state of Colorado sued the governor, a case called Smith against Hickenlooper, saying that they, the law enforcement officials, were forced to choose between their oath to the state law and their oath to federal law, right? Because we were permitting something the federal government wasn't. I never really understood that. I've asked some of the plaintiffs in that case to explain it. It still doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Oklahoma and Nebraska have joined that suit, and essentially the sheriffs and the states are saying, we continue to believe this is preempted by federal law. Yes. Yes. Alito and Thomas, and they didn't tell us exactly why. They made an interesting argument, not really on point for us. They said, look, Oklahoma and Nebraska have a complaint against Colorado. We should hear that. We're the only court available to hear that suit. But they weren't able to convince their brethren on that. So, yes. Yes. Absolutely. Oklahoma and Nebraska were explicit. They said, we understand that a sovereign state can legalize marijuana. What they said it can't do, license, regulate, and tax. That was part of the reason their suit was never a non-starter, because I think the Supreme Court would say, well, so your complaint is too much Colorado marijuana is coming into your state. So what you want us to do is get rid of regulations and make it legal in Colorado without regulation? You think that would be better for you? This is essentially the argument that Colorado made. It's the argument that the Solicitor General made on behalf of the United States. And I think it was part of the reason that the court ended up not taking the case. It essentially, Oklahoma and Nebraska were saying lawlessness would be better than what we have. I just don't think that's right. All right, so this is good news, the fact that these preemption suits have generally lost. But particularly in light of what we just heard about family law, there are a lot of collateral consequences that continue to stem from the fact that marijuana is illegal in the United States. Employment, right, is a big one. We all know the case of Brandon Coates here in Colorado. Mr. Coates is a quadriplegic. He was using marijuana to control seizures. He was working for Dish Network. Everyone seemed to agree he was never impaired at work. And in fact, that his work was only possible because he was able to control his seizures with medical marijuana. Dish Network has a zero tolerance policy. They tested him. He tested positive, not a big surprise. He said, you can't fire me. Colorado has a lawful off-duty conduct statute. Guess what the lawful off-duty conduct statute says? You can't be fired for engaging in lawful off-duty conduct. Where did this come from? Anyone know? Cigarettes. The cigarette companies went around the country passing these laws because people didn't want to hire smokers because they have higher absentee rates, harder to insure. Cigarette companies fought back by getting these statutes passed. They said, what a person does in their off hours, as long as it's legal, none of the employer's business. Mr. Coates said, that sounds like me. Unanimously, the Colorado Supreme Court disagreed. It said his conduct is not legal. It's prohibited by federal law. Right? Lawful off-duty conduct means conduct not prohibited by law. His conduct is prohibited by law. He is not entitled to benefit from that statute. Contract. My favorite case that I teach, a case called Hammer against Today's Healthcare. THC. Thank you. Right? This couple down in Arizona lent $500,000 to a Colorado dispensary. Colorado dispensary stopped paying. The Arizona couple said, well, we're smart. We're going to sue them here in Arizona, right? Judge is going to be very sympathetic to us when they hear what these out-of-town scoundrels are doing. THC drove down from Colorado, and what do you think they said when they showed up in Arizona? Contract's illegal. We're drug dealers. And they knew we were drug dealers when they lent us that money. That contract is unenforceable. And the Arizona judge says, you know what? You're right. You, Arizona couple, the Hammers, you lent money to drug dealers expecting to get paid back. Shame on you. Drug dealers go back to Colorado. Contract couldn't be enforced. And you might think, well, that's a great victory for marijuana. No. Right? It's not a big victory because why would anyone contract with the marijuana industry if the industry can run and hide behind the shield of its own illegality? There is a great, I know everything is sort of through the looking glass here. There's a great case from earlier this year. Judge Krieger, a federal judge here in Colorado, heard this insurance case between a company called Green Earth Wellness and Attain Specialty Insurance Company. I don't know how you guys feel about insurance companies. I don't like them. And I particularly don't like Attain, because here's what Attain did. Attain took premiums from this marijuana business. Then there was a fire in Colorado Springs, and the plants in the grow were hampered by the smoke that came in through the ventilation system. And they filed a claim. And Attain said, we're not going to pay for your drugs, your contraband that you were growing in there. That would be criminal. And Judge Krieger, a federal judge, said to the folks at Attain, did you know this was criminal conduct when you were accepting their premiums? We think you did. We think you can't take all those premiums and then run and hide and say, oh, no, that's illegal. We don't pay for illegal conduct, right? So contract now is a little more stable than it was at the time of Hammer against THC. But as long as marijuana remains illegal, it's tenuous. Bankruptcy. No, you weren't thinking we were going to talk about bankruptcy this morning. Debts incurred by a marijuana business are not dischargeable in bankruptcy. Why? Because the person seeking the protection of bankruptcy is violating federal law. Bankruptcy is a federal protection. Courts have consistently held bankruptcy totally unavailable to marijuana businesses. Now, if you owe money to someone, or someone owes money to you and they go bankrupt, well, they can discharge their debts as long as they're not a marijuana business. But you as a marijuana business don't get the same protections. This was a landlord who had lent who had leased a quarter of his facility to a marijuana business. So he wasn't actually a licensed business here in Colorado, nonetheless was held not to be able to get bankruptcy protection. Other collateral consequences of prohibition. Banking, enough said about banking. We've heard a lot about that. Tax, 280E, familiar to a lot of you. Marijuana businesses have to pay their taxes, can't take any deductions. Intellectual property. You can't get a patent or a trademark on your processes. If you're a business in the marijuana business, this is a big deal. In addition, there are lots of, and I often talk at some length, not just Mr. Coates' employment, people who receive federal benefits, people who live in federally subsidized housing, people who want federal student loans, institutions like my own that receive federal funds through grants, all of the and of course the parental rights, familial rights that we just heard about, all of those are impacted by the fact that marijuana remains illegal at the federal level. It's a great question, right? So can you say Dish Network was obligated to accommodate my seizure disorder by allowing me to take medical marijuana? I haven't seen a decided opinion on that. My guess is courts will say reasonable accommodations, yes, allowing you to break federal law and to put what Dish Network's argument essentially was, we have an obligation under the drug-free workplace law to prevent our employees from being impaired. And I think their point was, look, violating the federal law or allowing our employees to violate federal law is not a reasonable accommodation, right? That because this is a federal obligation, federal law would apply, and the fact that this is illegal conduct federally would prevent that claim. I haven't seen that, but that's my guess. In federal court, pretty unlikely. Well, this was a state. So this was a statutory protection that Mr. Coates sought, and the court found it unavailing. That's at state court. Yeah. So he made a state law argument in state court and lost unanimously. Right. Some of these things can be fixed through statute. The Colorado legislature could go back and say, by lawful off-duty conduct, we mean conduct lawful under state law. It's like a one-word fix. They haven't done so. I think part of the reason is they're worried about that conflict. They don't want Dish Network to be able to say, look, we have to decide which law to obey, the federal drug-free workplace law or the state law prohibiting us from firing people like Coates. Yeah. It might have been, though, that's not what the court didn't hang its head on that, right? It said, essentially, that's not what the statute says. The statute says legal. This isn't legal. Another place that this comes up is in probation and parole, right? That often a condition of probation or parole is commit no new offenses. Well, if you're a marijuana patient, if you have a card, if you're, you know, taking it medically or recreationally, you're committing new offenses every time you do so. And there's been a lot of litigation about whether probationers and parolees can use marijuana. All right, so, yes. So, if you don't describe it as a marijuana delivery system, you can probably get a patent for it. Whether you can enforce that patent in a federal court, I doubt it, right? I don't want to go too far afield, but the District of Colorado legal ethical rules, the court has said explicitly, you cannot represent marijuana clients. The state bar has said it's ethical. The federal bar has said explicitly, we accept all of the state rules on ethics except that one. You can't do that in our court. So you might be able to get a patent. Whether you could enforce it is anyone's game. All right. So, yes, question back. We have a separate statute in Colorado, I think, that says that this can be, that you can permit someone who's a probationer or a parolee to use marijuana. Judges ignore it, right? In the same way that you were talking about, there are judges who say, the legislature may have said that they can come tell this person they can smoke marijuana, I'm not going to. That raised a number of questions, yes. Yeah, I think that states that don't have, and Pennsylvania isn't one, but states that don't have any true medical marijuana rules, any THC rules, and don't have any lawful way to get it, but then are passing CBD rules are just cynical, right? Right. Right. So I think that, right, there's no lawful way for you to get it. You have to go to Colorado and buy it, then illegally bring it back to Pennsylvania, right? I think that's crazy. Right, I think that those states are—that's just cowardly. Because what they're finding is they get parents, they get kids that come before the legislature, say we need help. They say, okay, we won't prosecute you if you have this stuff, but we won't create a legal way for you to get it. Right? It's sort of the DEA could, the FBI could, the states that you're passing through could. It violates Colorado law to take it out of state. All Pennsylvania is doing is trying to put a pretty face on something, right? They're not making it possible legally for the parents to do that. They're putting those people at risk. Yes. So you can, there are certain things that you can do. You can make a good faith argument for a change or exception of the law, right? So you can say, I think Congress's power to regulate marijuana is unconstitutional, and here's why. What you can't do is help a marijuana business do business, right? In federal court. Yeah, I think, absolutely. I think that that insurance case, there is a very plausible argument that under the rule that the federal court has adopted, that lawyer was behaving, the lawyer for the business was behaving unethically. Now, I think that's crazy. I've written a law review article that says that's crazy. I think the Colorado rule is correct, but yes, in the state of Colorado, in the state courts, it's the longest, most torturous path. So I won't bore everyone with it, but it essentially, our rule says, rule 1.2D says, a lawyer shall not knowingly facilitate the criminal conduct of her client. Okay? Well, if you are representing a marijuana business, you are knowingly facilitating criminal conduct. Right? That's what our rule says. The Supreme Court, by a vote of 5-2, said, that doesn't prohibit lawyers from helping clients comply with state law. That if your client is a licensed business and you are helping them do business, Rule 1.2D doesn't apply, right? So that's exactly right. And what the federal court said was, that's great, Colorado, that's not our rule. You can't do that in our court, right? Even if you're helping your client comply. How am I doing on time? 10-12 minutes. All right, let me get to a punchline here, and then I'm happy to take questions. So where are we now? What is the way out of this sort of bizarre place where marijuana is legal in the states, but only kind of? We have some laws that have been introduced at the federal level. The CARES Act, Senators Booker et al. And I always try to remember what CARES is an acronym for. Respect States is how it ends. So the idea here is to allow the states, it essentially continues Rohrabacher Farr, prohibits the punishment of medical businesses and users in the states. Senator Sanders' bill obviously goes farther. The cleverly named End Federal Marijuana Prohibition Act would end federal marijuana prohibition. That is, it would remove the marijuana, not just from Schedule 1, but drop it all the way out of the Controlled Substance Act. Other bills would make hemp available, would make banking available for the industry, would allow more medical testing. But I'm sorry, and they would make the high CBD, low THC marijuana legal, regardless of its source, whether it came from marijuana or from hemp. And these are all really useful, and each of them would do a lot. But one of the things I want you a couple of things I want you to see. First, we were talking about this at breakfast this morning. Rescheduling marijuana might be the biggest disaster for everyone that's currently doing business in the marijuana space. Why? Well, imagine they move it from Schedule 1 to Schedule 2 and say, you know what? You folks at Normal who've been doing this for 30 years, you're absolutely right. We were wrong all along. Marijuana is medicine, and we're going to treat it just like OxyContin. How many people in this room would feel like that was a huge victory? Now, it might be an improvement, but if you're a marijuana business in the state of Colorado or California, Washington, Oregon, you're out of business. Why? Well, we don't let people sell OxyContin over the counter. We don't let doctors say, you would benefit from opiates. Go find someone that will sell you some opiates. And you don't go into a store and say, Percocet, OxyContin, opium. Opium sounds great. Which of these do you think I should use? Right? That's not the way we treat controlled substances in the United States. And while I think most of us in the room think, well, marijuana is medicine and has medical benefits, moving marijuana out of prohibited and into medicine might be a complete disaster, at least and particularly for the people that are currently distributing marijuana, producing marijuana, and selling it. This could be a big change. Furthermore, any true solution has to make marijuana not just not enforced, but legal in the States. If we're worried about the Brendan Coateses, if we're worried about the probationers and parolees, the parents, this conduct has to be made legal in the States, right? Not just, oh, we're going to continue to look the other way, as the CARES Act would say, but no, something affirmatively has to be done to make this conduct legal. Otherwise, we're going to continue to have all those collateral consequences. Another big point, any legislative solution is going to have winners and losers, right? There are people who are going to benefit, and the people are going to be hurt by whatever set of rules come about. So as we, let me just put a couple ideas up here, then I'll take that question. So for example, are we going to have one set of rules or 50? Right? With regard to opiates, we have one set of rules. Right? You have to be licensed by the federal government to prescribe them. You have to be licensed by the federal government to manufacture and distribute them. States can't say, we're a Percocet only state. Right? We only have opiates where ibuprofen is, or acetaminophen is involved. Right? No, there's one set of rules for all 50 states. What's the shape of the industry going to look like? Is it going to look like it does now? It's hard to imagine, right? Is it going to, what's going to happen to the people that are in the market now? Do they get a head start or are they kept out? One of the most controversial pieces of regulation in Colorado was what to do about people with criminal convictions for drug distribution. Initially, there was going to be a lifetime ban. If you had ever been convicted of a drug offense, you could not be licensed in the state of Colorado to produce marijuana. Well, who do you think knows how to produce marijuana? Right? People have been growing marijuana illegally for 20, 30, or 40 years. And who got prosecuted for marijuana in that time? Right? It wasn't the people that are running these things now. Part of the reason that the industry right now is overwhelmingly white and overwhelmingly upper middle class is because a lot of people are disqualified because of prior convictions. Right? So what happens to current players? What do we do to keep a legal marijuana market from replicating so many of the disparate impacts of an illegal marijuana market? The fact that whites and blacks use marijuana about the same rate, and blacks are 4 or 5 or 10 times more likely to be arrested for it and prosecuted for it, that's something we have to take into account. And I know this gets a lot of discussion, but I think this is probably the biggest question going forward is, how do we prevent a big marijuana industry from happening? Maybe people want a big marijuana industry. I do not. Right? I don't like what look in Colorado at the differences between alcohol stores and marijuana stores. Alcohol stores have neon signs out front. They have giant billboards. They create products. The alcohol business creates products to appeal to new drinkers. They create products to appeal to heavy drinkers. I do not want a marijuana industry that does that. Right? If you see a marijuana business, you have to look for it. There are a couple in Aspen. Good luck finding them. Right? I don't know if you've been out and looked. They're tough to find. They can't have billboards. They can't have neon signs. They can't advertise prices outside. They can have a green cross. They can have the name of their business. And they can tell you whether they're medical or recreational, and that's it. They are much less of an eyesore, much less of a nuisance than alcohol businesses are. And I would really like to keep it that way. All right. I see some questions. I'm going to take those, and then I will stop. Go ahead. I'm sorry? In Colorado, you can't do that. You can't, right? So you cannot, Great. The question was, what about advertising, price, and so forth? Colorado has very narrow, and this is, I'll just talk about Colorado. It's what I know best. You can only advertise in a publication or through a means where you can demonstrate that the vast majority of people are, viewers are adults, right? So you can't put it in a daily newspaper. Go ahead. Until recently, yeah. Right. No, so the Colorado has something pretty close to an outdoor advertising ban. It's almost certainly unconstitutional, right? It's a discrimination against the content of speech. Nonetheless, I think the industry has been fine with it because they want to present a positive. They don't want to look like alcohol. Right? So I think people have been willing to put up with that. Yeah.
One was,
Yeah, that's not going to be me. But let me say a few words about it. Most of these treaties, I think the U.S. was the driving force for these treaties. These are treaties that obligate the signatories to prevent the distribution and flow of prohibited substances, including marijuana. I think that most of the signatories to those treaties, particularly the ones in the Western Hemisphere, signed it because the U.S. required it, right? And threatened to impose sanctions, if people wouldn't. So it's true that our treaty obligations, to a large extent, would prevent the removal of marijuana from the Controlled Substances Act. My guess is that most of our neighbors would be fine with that, right? And you know, I was at the, I don't know how many of you were at the DPA conference in Denver 3 years ago, but there was a great panel I was on that was, there was folks from all over the Western Hemisphere, and one of the representatives from Jamaica said, you know, ganja is illegal in my country. You're the reason it's illegal in my country. We didn't criminalize it. You guys did. So if you guys are going to be legalized, and if you guys are going to have it, believe that we're going to as well, right? The only reason we were on board is because you essentially required it. Yeah. That's the UN General Assembly on the trade of drugs. Yeah. Thank you for that. Question in the back, yeah. Right. Right. I mean, this is one of the things that's really interesting to me is that, you know, I said the 24 states plus District of Columbia have passed some sort of marijuana legalization. By this time next year, I imagine that'll be 30 states, right? That's a super majority of the states, and an overwhelming majority of the people will be living in a state where marijuana is legal for some adults. This has led to very little momentum in Washington. Right, that I could count on, you know, the fingers of two hands how many politicians have been willing to expend actual capital to make that happen. Right? So you have this amazing situation where the people will get past 50% long before the, and you know, if you look at polling on this, it's over 55%. It's the politicians in Washington that are going to be the last ones coming along. Question here. Yeah, so when the Obama administration, I didn't talk about the Cole memo, but there was an official statement from the Obama Justice Department that essentially said, so long as you, the states, are meeting these 8 federal enforcement priorities, we will take a hands-off policy. Now, it's not enforceable, and it doesn't have the effect of law, but it gives some predictability. About 6 months later, they issued a second statement that said we will treat sovereign Indian nations the same way we treat states. So if you are able to comply with these 8 federal guidelines, you will get the same hands-off treatment, right? And there has been a lot of interest in a number of tribes and nations who are looking at what the states are doing or looking at what happened with gaming, with tobacco sales on reservations, saying, hey, this looks like a really useful Well, that's a fascinating one, right? So what if you're a tribe in North or South Dakota, right, which have no medical provisions, have no legal provisions? You can go to the tribe. The tribe can grow. The tribe can sell. You just can't leave the tribe. You can't leave tribal lands. Yeah, except the gambling you do there. Right. Exactly. So there'll be resort type situation, which is very different from the model any state has, right? You know, you heard about the fact that Colorado has no or very little social use provision, right? There's very few places that tourists can go and smoke. This would be a model based solely on tourism, right? People from outside the tribe come to the tribal lands, buy, use, and then leave. Right. Gamble, smoke tobacco, all the good stuff. I'm getting yanked.